The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson on Guardian.co.uk.
Barely have you finished rounding up one week of action, then another one goes and happens. Football Weekly. In today's show, what did Chelsea, Man United and a used teabag have in common? They're all out of the cup and a bit bitter. As football's oldest competition reels from an especially historic round of action, we salute the giant killers. And elsewhere, we get the latest from the Premier League. Fresh word from Spain and Italy, and something tasty from the top of the French table, with a bit of Bordeaux. There's your posts, and we look forward to the busy week of action that awaits in Europe, into Liverpool, and sundry UEFA delights. All that in Football Weekly.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Well, greetings, everybody, and greetings to our pod crew this week. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Right, smashing that stereotype about you not being cheery outside of Ghana. Ebullient and full of good cheer today.
It's 8:30 on a Monday morning. What do you want? And I've just heard a teacup joke about the FA Cup. Last time I heard that, I was in primary school.
Really?
It's an old one.
And not even a goodie.
Sean Ingle, welcome back.
Hi there, James.
Hi. How was your trip?
It was great.
Tell us about the celebrities.
I saw Moby, aka James Richardson. A vegetarian restaurant called Counter.
Yeah.
He was eating cakes, just like you often do. I saw James
Spooky, isn't it?
Gandolfini in an art shop called Blick. I also got hit down with a virus, which left me with more hot flushes than a menopausal woman in a heatwave. And now I've got a streaming cold, so apologies if I'm more incoherent than usual.
I hadn't noticed any difference, I have to say. Barry Glendenning, welcome to you.
Hi. I should, as Paul said, it's 8:30 on a Monday morning.
It's 9:00 on a Monday morning.
Yeah, well,
people
dragged us out of bed because of other commitments you have, which are, as usual, more important than the one you have to us. We all had to get out of bed at 6:30, and on the worst...
It was one bed. Can I just point out, it
Monday
was one
morning.
Big bed we were all in.
Yeah.
And we all
we're like Morecambe and Wise. We're all sleeping
the reasons for
bed.
A bad mood are becoming very clear.
Anyway.
Jimbo was hogging the duvet.
That's contractual, of course. Yeah. Now, Corleone posting in, FA Cup, and he says, more shocks this weekend than an electric eel's wedding night, Jimbo.
Was he reading your joke book?
No, and Wonk saying, can we now officially rename it the Schadenfreude Cup? What a weekend of action. Remember when the draw was made and everyone said, oh, how boring, there are not going to be any upsets. My word.
Well, it's great, isn't it?
Is it, Barry? Because
Sean
immediately instituted a blog on the Guardian Unlimited site saying, you know, does this completely devalue the entire notion of the FA Cup having other teams apart from the big ones in?
But nobody wants the big ones in the final, but now it's become apparent that no one wants the small ones in the final either. Maybe one big one and one small one.
Well, no, it hasn't devalued it because they did get there on merit. It wasn't because all the Premier League teams rested their top stars and everything. They got there on merit. And it's also pleasing to note that the FA... are going to have to slash the prices for the FA Cup semi-final because the likes of Barnsley, etc. don't have enough fans to fill Wembley.
Now, the reason that they're actually moving their semi-finals to Wembley is because Wembley is so massively expensive to keep up that they have to just bring fixtures in from other places.
Exactly. Yeah.
So will the clubs not be out of pocket because they won't be able to use their own stadiums for the...
Well, presumably.
Well, they never got to use their own stadiums. So the semi-finals were always at a neutral venue.
Yeah, yeah. Fair dues.
Keep up, Jimbo.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, three teams outside the top flight for the first time since 1908, fact fans. And as you say, Paul, they all deserve to be there. Let's a quick chortle through them. Cardiff outplaying Borough. One report saying that Cardiff won't have had an easier game all season in the Championship than this one.
Borough were appalling. You know, for a team that they knew that Chelsea were out, they knew that Manchester United were out, and they didn't really. They seemed lackadaisical. They just, you know, and Cardiff thoroughly deserved their win.
I don't know if it was arrogance on Borough's part or if they just are that bad, but it was a dismal performance. And watching Mido, you know, flob around the pitch, he's an absolute disgrace. He's so overweight. And you'd have to wonder, I mean, what is Gareth Southgate doing letting players in that deplorable condition onto his first team?
Mm. Why, it's a fair question, Sean.
Well, I know he's had injuries this season, but he's been back now for a good month or so, and it doesn't... You know, you're a professional sportsman. You know, I was chatting to David Hay about losing weight, and he managed to lose a stone in 10 days, so I'm sure the Mido...
Was he in the vegetarian restaurant as well?
No, he wasn't. Oh. He's a boxer, for people that don't know. He's a cruiserweight boxer.
But he's just become the super welter featherweight type.
He's a triple world champion now. He's moving up. But, you know, he's had lots of problems making the weight, and there are, you know, if you're a sports... you know,
but he beat Enzo Macaronelli, didn't he?
He did.
There you go.
But very good, Jimbo. But if you know, if you are, you know, you have, and you know, Borough do have, they have lots of sports scientists. They have people that should know what they're doing, and it's not that difficult with a, you know, mixture of diet and exercise. But you know, Mila doesn't
that's
seem
the key
to
word,
either.
I think, exercise.
I'm not saying like that. The difference between Borough winning and losing is 24 pounds of Egyptian blubber, but you know, it doesn't look good, really, does it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on to Man United then. Pompey, Portsmouth's first win in the Old Trafford for 50 years or something, wasn't it? And all sorts of good sportsmanship shown by the defeated United post-game. I do understand their complaints about the refereeing, because it was pretty much a stonewall penalty on Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well, it's a classic United ploy that, you know, if you get beaten, divert attention away from the performance and blame others.
The performance wasn't that bad, though. It was just their finishing that was off.
Their finishing was poor, and they were probably the better team, and they were unlucky to lose, and they should have had a penalty, but the rant Fergie went off on afterwards was spectacular, even by his standards, and I presume he's going to get hauled over the coals for it. You know, referees can't be seen to go to Old Trafford and give penalties to the away team. It's just not acceptable.
I mean, it was a penalty, but Kuchak should never have been sent off. I mean, I think it's a ridiculous rule that we have, that, you know, if it's a goal scoring opportunity, because, I mean, he took him out with his head, and, you know, you couldn't do that if you tried, I think. You know, he went for the ball, missed, it was a penalty, but it shouldn't have been the sending off. Mm. You know, Ronaldo's penalty.
Oh, if you take someone out with your head. But no, it's clearly reckless.
It was reckless, but it wasn't
Therefore, he had to be sent off. It was a clear goal scoring opportunity.
But why? The law's an ass in this case,
well,
I think.
Well, the law exists.
But the
and the ref has to enforce it. So.
But he should have given a penalty, and that would have been the end of the matter. I mean, I did enjoy Rio Ferdinand's dive.
Yes. yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. And they're out. West Brom, Bristol Rovers. Woof. West Brom. How about that for some free-flowing attacking football?
Well, I thought both sides actually went for it. The problem too much with football these days is because there's, you know, a clear line between, you know, the haves and the have-nots. You know, there's always a team that you think is better that attacks, a team that isn't so good that's, you know, sits, you know, 10 men behind the ball and tries to hold on. But last night, I thought both teams just really went for it. And I thought Bristol Rovers were a bit unlucky, really, to be.
Yeah, they weren't unlucky. They were,
to
they
be
were completely outclassed. They looked like a League One team. West Brom looked like a team from a division above.
No, I'm not saying West Brom didn't deserve to win, but I thought Bristol Rovers hung in there and made it. You know, both teams went
for it. They
didn't.
They were absolutely slaughtered.
Barnsley-Chelsea, folks. Barnsley, what's the story here? Why are they in trouble? They're hanging around the relegation zone in the Championship. They've beaten Liverpool at Anfield. They're now beaten Chelsea at home. And as you were saying, Paul, deservedly so.
Yeah, well, the win over Liverpool was slightly freakish because Liverpool had a million shots. The win over Chelsea...
Chelsea didn't, did they?
No, that was an entirely deserved. They completely outplayed them. I don't know why. I wonder if Abraham Grant does.
Right. Well, no, I was just curious as to why Barnsley couldn't translate that form into their kind of league campaign. But as for Chelsea, that's a nasty blow for Avram Grant, who's now back in the donkey box, isn't he, after rescuing his reputation with a couple of good wins. All sorts of bad noises coming out of Cobham as to his lack of hold over the team. And it does seem to be that since players returned from Africa and came back from injury, and he actually had to make some choices, that the whole thing is gone to pieces a bit.
Well, they had an easy-ish run of games, which I think helped. I mean, God, I think you could put Barry and myself in charge of that Chelsea team, and we know we'd beat, you know, bottom of the table sides. He had to make some.
I don't know about that.
But would he beat Barnsley?
But you know, it can't. I mean, to play Malouda, Joe Cole, and Sean White Phillips in the same team didn't make sense. To bring, you know, not to bring Frank Lampard when he wants to play, and he's an English player that passionately cares about the FA Cup.
Because when they lost in the Carling Cup, it was all because he played Frank Lampard.
Yeah, but Lampard, I think, wasn't particularly fit then. I think he, you know, he's had a couple of weeks to get back into fitness. He actually cares about the tournament, but I think perhaps not every single Chelsea player.
Do you think not enough English players then was the problem?
Possibly. I think more so someone like Lampard, I think, is box to box. And Chelsea needed someone, I think, to make those runs up to help Anelka. And no one was really doing that.
So is it because no one was making the runs or because no one had the right passport?
Bit of both, perhaps.
No, interesting. We're the only English people in this pod, and we care deeply about this. But I noticed that Barry and Paul are eager to move on to other issues. They're just not English.
Ruining your game,
right? Listen,
I didn't say that.
Let's now Chelsea. They do have Derby on Wednesday, which should give them a chance to bounce back, and that is a game in hand for them, which would enable them to move within 4 points of the top of the table. Yeah.
Well, you'd expect them to do it. Derby aren't going to stop them doing it, are they?
Yeah. Well, there you go. So they're still very much in the mix as regards the title. But a shocking defeat, that, and well done to Barnsley. And who's our favourite now for the cup? Is it Portsmouth?
I suppose it has to be Portsmouth, but any of the four could win it. I think a Portsmouth-West Brom final would be probably the best you could hope for. But would anyone bet against Barnsley?
Would you want to bet against Barnsley given what they've done? I mean, full credit to everybody, but they are the ultimate story from this bag of...
They were lucky to beat Liverpool. They totally deserved their win against Chelsea, as Paul said, and... You know, they won't fear anyone at this stage. So the draw hasn't been made yet, obviously, but I think it's this lunchtime. And,
That's what I've got to get off to.
Oh, is it?
Now, elsewhere in the Premier League, Newcastle had a big win. Liverpool had a big win over Newcastle. Newcastle, of course, haven't had a big win over anybody or a win of any nature since Kevin Keegan arrived. And they are now level on points with Reading, thanks to Reading's home win over Man City. Those two teams, the Royals and the Magpies, 3 points above Bolton and Birmingham, who have a game in hand. So we could end up with... it's all got very, very nasty there for Keegan.
Well, I noticed in today's match report in The Guardian, Keegan's talking about winning trophies. He says he's not going to win league titles, but he's going to win trophies. So he obviously has an eye on the playoff final next season, I think. That joke was funnier than your teabag thing at the start. But no.
I'm not denying it. Now, West Ham got beaten 4-0 again. The Curbs Crawlers are really struggling, aren't they?
They are, and
but isn't it the problem that they're just stuck in mid-table? They're 8 points ahead of Spurs. They're not going anywhere.
They're a bit like Curbishly themselves, really. West Ham. They, as you say, they're not good enough to challenge the top four or five. They're not bad enough to get relegated. There was a big story in yesterday's Observer newspaper from Jamie Jackson, who basically quotes some West Ham insiders who are all very unhappy about Curbishley and think he might get sacked before the end of the season. I've been in a couple of press conferences with Alan Curbishley over the years, and I've interviewed him before, and he must be the single most uninspiring manager I've ever spoken to. If you ever need to fall asleep, and God, I needed to last night, he's the man. Just listen to one of his press conferences.
Well, having said that, you kept him up last year.
Yeah, he did.
Look at the job he did at Charlton. Bless, you know, with the limited resources, etc.
But he wouldn't. I can't see how he'd inspire anyone to, you know, believe they could, you know, reach for the stars.
Plus, he's bought players though who you would think are beyond being motivated. Freddie Ljungberg was a bad purchase. He's clearly at the end of his career.
80 Boa grand Morte, a week.
Yeah, Boa Morte the same. Lucas Neal, after Curbishley railed against the baby Bentley culture, he brought in Lucas Neal, who clearly was only going there for the money.
He was quite specific about it, wasn't he?
Well, no, he insisted it wasn't to do with the money, but I think we all know it was.
Right. Yeah, he's bought badly.
Right, so thumbs down for Alan Curbishley, who may soon be ending.
Can I say though, in fairness, I've also interviewed him, and he is dull and boring, but he's a very nice man. Yeah. He's a decent chap.
I shared a pizza once with Alan Curbishley.
What toppings?
Oh, I can't remember. I think there was a broad selection of pastry bases and various
pizzas.
Condiments.
Yeah, plural.
Well, yeah, I wasn't the only. It wasn't an intimate tete-a-tete we were
at Pizza Express.
No, it wasn't. It was in a large aircraft hangar-like studio in Maidstone, Kent, and we were enjoying together some Brazil games on a satellite channel. And he was the kind of pundit for obvious reasons, which escaped me at the moment. But anyway, and he was a very pleasant man. I mean,
you know, his brother is the manager of the Who.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
So I think maybe if his brother went to West Ham, if he could whip Keith Moon into shape, Craig Bellamy and Lucas Neal shouldn't be beyond him.
I don't know how much success he had whipping Keith Moon into shape, if memory serves me. Right, anyway, well, there you go. That's a fairly broad-ranging part one. In part two, we're going to be focusing on Spain and possibly one or two other things too. For example, Ligue 1, Le Championnat. Oui?
Yeah.
Okay, that's all extremely, extremely imminent. We'll see you in a second.
Hello, I'm Robert Freeman, and on the latest Media Talk podcast...
I have told my grandmother. She actually told me. she told me I'm off to Afghanistan, so that was the way. That was the way it was supposed to be.
We discuss the Prince Harry media blackout and ask, just how do you keep a secret in the internet age? Also in the show, is former Observer editor Roger Alton about to replace Simon Kellner at The Independent? Plus, what now for Wildlife TV after David Attenborough bids adieu? It's all on the new Media Talk, guardian.co.uk/audio.
Football Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Right then, time now to hear more about all things Spanish with Sid Lowe in Spain. How are you doing, Sid?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
We're well, to save you the bother of asking.
No, I didn't bother asking this time, because last time I was accused of responding to you in the same way by saying, well, I'm well, thank you, how are you? So I thought I wouldn't bother asking this time, yeah.
All right, I'm glad we cut all that out. And got straight to the heart, heart of the matter. Yep. Listen, Sid, is it all over then in the Liga?
It should be, really and truly it should be. I'm reluctant to say so just because it's gone up and down quite a bit in the last few weeks, but Madrid now have an 8-point lead. Barcelona don't have Leo Messi, and Madrid don't have anything else to worry about. They have no Copa del Rey, obviously no European Cup anymore either. And to some extent, this happened last season, that if Madrid hadn't got knocked out of the Champions League at the point they did against Bayern Munich, I've got absolutely no doubt that they wouldn't have won the league. They now have a week to prepare every single game. They're getting most of their players fit again. And regardless of whether or not Madrid can do it, I just don't see Barcelona picking up enough points now to win the league.
Henri, Ronaldinho and Eto'o not really setting the world on fire against Villarreal on the weekend.
No, and to some extent it was kind of inevitable that Villarreal would maybe not win the game, but certainly take something from the Camp Nou, because they've consistently got very good results against Barcelona, particularly at Madrigal, but also at Camp Nou. They've had a couple of pretty good results over the last 3 or 4 years. They're the kind of side that play the perfect football to beat Barcelona. They're very good at soaking up pressure, very good at allowing Barcelona to come onto them and then hitting them on the break. And Barcelona at the back still look ever so slightly wobbly, and they're just not scoring the chances, not creating really clear chances that their football demands.
Sid, I was impressed by Senna last night. He seemed to run the show in midfield, Villarreal.
I think he's brilliant. I think he's almost certain. He is pretty much certain to go to the European Championships. The question mark is whether he starts. I think he may well start for Spain, because David Albelda, of course, has just had this court case with Valencia, which incidentally he lost. So he's not playing any football right now. So Marcos Senna, I think, probably will get the nod for Spain. I think he's a really, really good footballer.
What does that mean, Albelda losing his court case?
Well, basically what Albelda was claiming was that he wanted to be allowed to walk away from his contract at Valencia, and he wanted Valencia to have to pay €60 million in order for him to do so. The court has turned down his demand to be allowed to go free. They've obviously, therefore, as a consequence of that, turned down his demand for €60 million. And so now Valencia and Albelda are negotiating a negotiated departure for him, which is something that obviously they should have done before it got to court in the first place.
Just the Albelda court case, I didn't fully understand. He wanted Valencia to pay €60 million. Who would they have had to pay that €60 million to? Him?
To him, yeah. Basically, the reason that David Albelda wanted that is that all clubs in Spain, every player has an official buyout clause. And that official buyout clause is the money in which you can pay, and it's always prohibitively high, the money that you can pay to buy a player without that club wanting to sell him. So, in other words, the really famous case was Real Madrid buying Luis Figo off Barcelona, because his buyout clause was €40 million. So Real Madrid deposited €40 million at the Spanish Football Federation, and Barca couldn't stop him going. Now, obviously, those buyout clauses are set so high that most people would never buy a player for that fee. I think Messi's, for example, is €150 million, and David Albelda's was €60 million. Now, what Albelda was saying is, okay, so what you're saying here is, if I was to ever unilaterally break my contract with you to go to another club, I would effectively have to pay €60 million to do it, or the team that was buying me would have to pay €60 million to do it. As you're effectively unilaterally not allowing me to fulfil my job with the club by not picking me, by telling me I'll never play again, by making me train on my own, then I want €60 million as well. Because hang on a minute, if I'm worth €60 million if I break your promise, I've got to be worth €60 million if you break mine. The judge didn't see it that way.
Can you get my agent on line one?
Thanks, Sid.
That's fantastic, Sid. You were saying Real Madrid have now got a week to prepare all their games. Obviously, they were coming off their defeat to Roma midweek this time around, but they still didn't look very impressive, did they, as they scraped past Espanyol with a dodgy penalty?
They were rubbish. They scored one goal with a player's knee, the other goal with a penalty, which personally I don't think was a penalty. Real was certainly, there was some contact on Real, but if anything, the hand was pulling him backwards, yet somehow Real managed to propel himself forwards, which I think tells you everything about the nature of the penalty. And Madrid won 2-1 and really weren't impressive. But we come back to what we've been saying all year. Madrid are not a great football team, but they just have this ability. So in recent weeks, it's dropped away a bit, but they have this ability to get away with it and to win games without playing particularly well. And the key factors are, for me, that Schneider's coming back now. He's not had a brilliant season, but he does something that no one else does. You've got Robinho, who's just sort of a bit up and down, but coming back to fitness now. Ruud van Nistelrooy will be back next week, and Sergio Ramos will be back from suspension. And those are the four players, or four of maybe five players, who sort of disguise the fact that the rest of the team's fairly average.
Sid, I've got a couple of questions here from the Post. Matey Mate wants to know why Deportivo, who were just a few years ago Champions League regulars, are now struggling at the wrong end of La Liga. They're just, 2 points off the bottom three. What's gone wrong?
The bottom line is there's no money. Deportivo, what went wrong, I think, and this is something that probably at some stage needs quite an in-depth analysis, but basically when Deportivo built their enormous success, they built it on the basis of buying very good players, and there was no foundation stone to it. So they bought some very, very good players, but they had no youth system. They had no one coming up from below. Every single player they got cost them money, and they tended to buy experienced players, so they never really recuperated any of the money on those players. As soon as the money ran out, which it was always going to, because it was just impossible to maintain that level at a club that doesn't often fill its stadium, that doesn't really have the basis of a big club, because, of course, it was a club, Deportivo, that came from nowhere. Then as soon as the wheels started to come off, the whole thing collapsed completely. They're in massive debt. Really and truly, they don't have that many very good players. I think they're going to survive this year, but they need to sort something out, and they need to do it quickly. They need to start by building a decent youth system.
Oh, interesting. Winters, meanwhile, asking Sid why he thinks that Torres has been overachieving at Liverpool. Overachieving because a lot of people, and I think if memory serves, we here on the pod as well, started out the campaign by saying that Torres will be a good player, but he won't be a 20 goals a season striker.
Yeah, and he's only one away from that, and I will include myself in that. But yeah, at the start of the season, I said he is a very good player. He's very, very talented. He's quick and he's athletic, but he wasn't really an out-and-out goal scorer. I think there's two or three things that have changed, and not very long ago, I did an interview with Torres and asked him these very questions, and some of the arguments that he put across are really quite convincing. One of them is that he at Liverpool doesn't feel the responsibility to carry the team like he did at Atletico Madrid, and that means two things. Psychologically, it means I think he's in better shape. He doesn't feel the pressure. But I think in footballing terms, it means that he doesn't have to drop deep and try and get involved in the play as much as he did at Atletico Madrid. And as he puts it, he can basically just hang around waiting to score and get himself and concentrate his game in certain areas of the pitch. I also think that he's really quite enjoying the style of English football as against the style of Spanish football. The fact that it's a little bit quicker, it's a little bit more direct, which suits the way.
And the defending is a little less expert.
Well, I think the defending is perhaps a little tougher, but perhaps a little less well organised. And Torres quite likes the fight, if you like, and I think he's quite enjoyed the physical side of it. And I think more than anything else, it's that the English game really suits his style, perhaps more than it did when he was in Spain. And also, the truth is as well, he's playing for a better team now. That might be hard to believe for people watching the Premiership at the moment.
Atleti, meanwhile, doing well without him. They're tied with... Who are they tied with in fourth place?
Well, they're tied with fourth place, bizarrely enough, with Racing Santander as the greatest season in Racing's history. Atletico are sort of doing all right, but no one's quite satisfied because they have a really terrible second half of the season. Although they beat Barcelona last week, that was, I think, only their second win in the second half of the season. And in Spain, it does matter to say second half of the season because the two halves are mirror images. So in other words, you play everyone once, and then the second half of the season you play everyone once again in the same order. And they've had a really poor time in the second half of the season. But the other teams around them have perhaps not really been able to take advantage. Sevilla, obviously Valencia are terrible this season. Espanyol have had an awful second half of the season as well. So Atletico should get that Champions League place. The truth is they're not a brilliant side, Atletico, but they do have three or four very good players.
Sidney, thank you very much indeed for that. And look forward to catching up with you on Thursday.
Thank you. You know it's not Sidney, but Simon.
Why is he called Sid then?
I've known Sid for 15 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why? Tell us why.
I don't know. I've just always been Sid. I presume it's because my father's a bit of a muppet. I don't know.
Crikey. Can't say that.
My father was a bit of a muppet when I'm not called Sid.
Right.
No, that's true.
You've got to remember, like, Sid's father. The father that wrote to 442 about his
shirt collection.
Yes.
No. Hang on, my father's mug collection. He happened to mention my shirt collection while he was at it.
Right,
I stand corrected.
Just to prove that there were two sad bastards in the family, not just one.
God bless you all, Sid Lowe and your dad. Now, thanks, Sidney. And next up on the line, on the mic rather, it is Paul Doyle with his Le Championnat roundup, because there's been an exciting weekend, a long-awaited first versus second style showdown.
Yeah, Lyon against Bordeaux. Oof. Lyon were top. They comprehensively won 4-2. They're now 6 points clear at the top with a far superior goal difference. So well on their way to a seventh successive title. There's only 10 matches left. Six of them are away, and Lyon have struggled on the road occasionally this season, but you can't see them letting it slip. And basically they did to Bordeaux what they should have done to Manchester United, or at least should have tried to do, as far as that they went all-out attack from the start and had men pouring through from midfield and were two up within 20 minutes. Mathieu Bodmer, who didn't start against United, scored both the goals, which was great for him. He just joined from Lille last summer and as an attacking midfielder, but he spent most of the season so far filling in at centre-back because of their injury crisis. So at last he got a chance to play in his preferred position in a big match, and he took it. And his second goal is well worth checking out on YouTube because it's a sensational goal. A little chip over a defender and then a scissors volley volley from the edge of the box shows he's got far too much skill to be playing at centre-back.
Crikey.
And Bordeaux got back into it with a terrible blunder by Gregory Coupe in goals, and then Benzema made it 3-1 with a typically brilliant goal. He was actually stationed out in the left again, which he doesn't like. He just decided to basically ignore Perrin's instructions and march all across the front line. And Fred, who was the lone striker, was... what are you doing, James?
For the benefit of our listeners, our presenter, James Richardson, appears to be making some sort of tent out of a copy of
L'Equipe is a very big paper.
I'm
a very small presenter.
While
so
Paul
I could
is
make
struggling
a
gamefully to give us a roundup Barry. Of what happened in
okay.
the.
Okay. Are you
the
suggesting that it in any way might distract somebody talking if I open a newspaper or in any way rustle pieces of paper?
Yes.
Are you doing a Serie A?
You spend the entire pod doing exactly that. Every single week.
All right.
But thank you very much for coming.
But I don't do it while you're talking directly to me.
So, oh, I see. Right. Yeah. I thought Paul was addressing. Well,
what are you making, though?
No, I just wanted to see what the headline was after this big first versus second showdown for the title.
Lyon
what did L'Equipe say?
Means yes. Lyon keeps its seat. Keeps their place.
Okay.
Paul, can I ask you what this means for Alain Perrin? Because he's been under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, what it means is he'll almost certainly get at least another season. Well, he only got a 2-year contract in the first place, so he won't be sacked this summer, basically. Had they lost to Bordeaux and lost the title, then he probably would have been. Well, I think he certainly deserves to complete his second season, because although he has made some mistakes, notably in terms of selection in big matches, he's also had to contend with some really freakish bad luck in terms of injuries to key players. And, of course, the fact that a lot of the other key players are coming to the end of their footballing lives. They're getting old. So he has to try and oversee that transitional period. And he doesn't make the transfers also. So whereas people like Abdelkader Keita, the record signing, hasn't done particularly well this season, Perrin didn't buy him. So, although having said that, he scored last night his first goal for the club at last, so maybe he's starting to come good on the back of a very good African Nations Cup.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that wraps things up for part two, and very shortly we're going to be looking forward to one or two other issues and getting your posts and the midweek action and all that kind of thing, so we'll see you in a second.
Football Weekly with James Richardson on guardian.co.uk.
Part three, a quick nod to the posts. Fernando was excellent, says pretty much everybody and worth more airtime. Zabur wants us all to buy some pixels on Stockport County's innovative new scheme to raise money to buy back Edgeley Park.
We featured that appeal in the Fiver last week for all the good I thought it would do. I didn't think there was any harm. And apparently the response was so overwhelming that the website crashed.
Right.
So Fiver readers in generosity, shocker.
Well, there you go, Zuckum or something of that nature in Dublin. Whatever happened to Freddie Adu? He asks us, because we're obviously the go-to guys for that kind of question.
He's at Benfica.
Well, he is, but is he any good?
I don't know.
Because he was going to be, you know, the next big thing.
I have to say, my knowledge of the Portuguese league is probably on a par with your knowledge of the Portuguese league, which is nil. I don't know a thing about it.
Well, I watched Benfica against Sporting Lisbon there, I think it was last week or the previous week, and he wasn't playing.
Right. Doesn't bode well for his prospects. Italy, papers at the ready, guys. Right, Roma had a 2-0 win at Napoli, who'd beat Inter the week before, so still 6 points on top. Milan are just 1 point off their quest for a top four. Just 1 point off the top four, because Fiorentina lost away to Siena, Massimo Macaroni with an excellent free kick, and Milan won 3-1 at Empoli. Just, they got two goals in the last 5 minutes. They do look awful.
What is it about Siena at home? I mean, they've beaten Roma.
They're good now. They've got Mario Barreto back, who's the man. I don't know why they didn't keep him in the first place, but there you go.
How is Signor Macaroni getting on?
Well, by the sound of it. I mean, I've seen him, when I've seen Siena, he does look lively. He doesn't get many goals, but he always looks lively. And the problem was that he was playing for a team who, until Barreto came back, I don't want to oversimplify things, weren't constructing a huge amount. But now they are, I think, a very dangerous outfit again. Inter, meanwhile, beat Regina 2-0 in the big centenary match, because they, on the 9th, when was that, yesterday? Yeah.
Yeah,
they were actually 100 years old, Inter, founded as an offshoot of Milan, when some foreign players at Milan got upset about the fact that all the privileges were being given to Italian players. They decided to march off and found their own club, which they called, appropriately enough, Internazionale, in whenever that was, 1908. and renamed Ambrosiana by Mussolini, or under the Mussolini regime, because he felt that Internazionale had echoes of the, you know, the
socialist,
exactly, yeah,
anthem.
So, but anyway, and there you go. And currently champions of Italy, and currently about to go out of the Champions League, because on Tuesday night they play Liverpool. And whilst it's not impossible that they could come back from 2-0 down, which was the result at Anfield, it's kind of unlikely if you look at the way they played against Regina.
You've not changed your tune since last week.
Yeah, but I've seen them play against Regina. They were once again really, really shocking. Julio César, their goalie, was the best player. There was a fairly laughable penalty, as usual, involved in proceedings, and I don't think Regina deserved to lose particularly. But
so is this just a bad year in Italian football then, in terms of the league, Inter being so far ahead and not being very good?
Well, Inter just seem to bottle it every time they go into Europe. We've seen this every year from them in Europe. I mean, maybe they're going to turn it around. Papers are full of the fact that last time Inter won the Champions League, or European Cup as it were, was back then, parochially enough. It was, 1965, 43 years ago. They'd lost 3-1 at Anfield to Liverpool in the first leg, and they came back and won it 3-0 at the San Siro and went on to win the title.
It's a bit hard to accuse them of bottling here. They had Materazzi sent off in, 32nd minute and conceded 2 late goals.
But not specifically. I'm just saying that every time they get into Europe, they get a certain amount of the distance. You think, OK, now they're going to do. Now they know what they need to do, they're going to do it. Like when they had Valencia last year, they knew what they had to do and they didn't do it. They didn't even start to bother trying to do it until the last 5 minutes of the game. The year before that, Villarreal, when they got attacked by their own fans on the way back from Spain, when they just completely lost interest in the game, as far as I could tell. It's like they almost expect somebody else to come up and do the playing for them, and then when the 5 minutes to go, they realise that nobody's turned up. It's, we better roll up our sleeves and do it ourselves. Curse the staff. I don't hold that much hope.
I was going to say, are the players making any noises about coming back? You know, if they.
Yeah, they're all making, we know it can be done. And of course, with the centenary, there was a parade of 200 glorious old Inter players and one or two less glorious ones. And Toribio West was there without his funny, dreadlock things.
Hair, I think it's called.
Yeah, it's the one. My memories. There's all sorts of talk about how, the Corso and everybody did it back in 65 and they can do it this time. But you just... I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but Benitez is right up his street, no? To play for a 0-0. That's exactly the kind of game that he excels at. Plus, half of Inter's team are either off-injured or not exactly in full fitness. I mean, Kivu's going to be playing with a dislocated shoulder because there's nobody else. Materazzi obviously suspended and Cordoba's out injured, etc., etc. And then you've got Torres, who's really tearing things up at the moment. So it doesn't really bode well. Although one of my neighbours, who's extraordinarily good at predicting such things, has assured me, just after he told me that Roma would definitely go through against Real Madrid, that Inter would qualify. No problem. So there you go.
Talking of being extraordinarily good at predicting things,
yes.
The pick-to-score league is worth a look.
Is it?
Yeah, but yeah. Specifically the second place position.
Oh, yeah? Are you in second place, Paul Dodd?
Yeah, making a surge.
Wow, nice one, because I haven't looked at this for a while back, and it was always Sean Ingle in the day.
I missed a couple of weeks, and I've been hammered.
Now, moving on, Champions League is not the only European action midweek, is it, Barry?
No, it isn't. There's Eurovase, UEFA Cup as well. Everton are losing. Everton are goal down to PSV.
Yeah, no, Everton are goal down to... Two goals down to Fiorentina. They were completely played off the park by Fiorentina. Tottenham then got beaten at home by PSV and were completely played off the bat. Well, there might be slight exaggeration. But isn't it does seem to say that, yeah, England's top four or big four are better than the rest of Europe, but the Champions League, the Premier League is not necessarily on a par with Serie A or indeed the other.
Yeah, but how many teams has Spain got left in the UEFA Cup? One? Getafe, I think? How many teams have Italy got left in the UEFA Cup?
One. But it was just interesting to see the way that, Fiorentina went into this game without their number one player.
No, Mutu, I agree with you, but...
Took on Everton, who were in fantastic form. It was embarrassing to
watch. I agree completely. I'm saying, though, but I think the assumption you made, I don't think it's quite right.
No, you're right. I'm probably making a wrong assumption, but the assumption I'm making is in response to another very wrong assumption, which is when you see Arsenal and Man United and probably this week Liverpool and the other one, Chelsea, going through in the Champions League, you think, that's it. More proof that the Premier League is the best. What it actually means is these incredibly rich clubs that completely dominate the Premier League will also completely dominate in Europe. But the rest of the Premier League doesn't necessarily have the same standard as their counterparts.
No, elsewhere. I agree with you completely.
There's still scope, surely, for Fiorentina to do an Inter-style collapse on Merseyside.
Well, there is, but I don't think they... touching wood. But I don't know that they will.
How did Bolton get on last week?
Well, they got a draw, didn't they? 1-1 it is with Sporting. And Bayern Munich, the team to beat, of course, they beat Anderlecht 5-0 in their first leg. Madrid. So they'll be looking forward to the second one, which they'll be at home. And who else? PSV, Tottenham, Sporting. Rangers, of course, who beat Werder Bremen 2-0. Now, that was quite a result. And then they've now got to do the away leg. So... Interesting.
Is it? No? I think it's going to be interesting to get excited about the UEFA Cup.
What's that point of the campaign? For those teams, they're beginning to...
I can understand their fans are going to start getting excited.
I think
now,
20 years ago, we all would have got excited about the UEFA Cup, the Champions League, even the FA Cup, because it mattered then.
20 years ago, I got excited about Curly Willies and Matt Loughter.
No, but we did that, and because they were important, winning the league was always the most important thing, winning the European Cup was the most important thing, but not very far behind with the other tournaments.
Yeah.
These days, you know, with the teams entering second string sides throughout most of the competitions, it's hard, you know, if the teams aren't that bothered about UEFA
Cup.
Well,
it's not the team's fault, it's UEFA's fault. They completely destroyed the whole structure.
Fair enough, but then if they're not bothered, UEFA aren't bothered, the teams aren't particularly bothered, then why should the fans be bothered?
I think some of the teams are bothered, and I think Rangers' victory over Bremen is worth hailing, because it does show that I think per capita, Scotland's probably the most successful football country in Europe. They have a very small population. Four or five million, which is the same as Ireland. And they have a relatively vibrant domestic league, and they've got two clubs that can be considered European forces. They're light years ahead of Ireland.
That's interesting. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into that, or indeed any facts and figures to back up any counter arguments.
Scotland's population is only about 5 million.
What about Holland? What's Holland's population? I mean, again, off the top of my head,
12 million.
But again, I think trophies and international victories.
Holland obviously an extraordinary thing. And I'd have to put who else would I have to put in there? Croatia. That's who I'd have to put in. Croatia.
No, they haven't done it over a long enough period yet. Scotland have been doing it since 1967, at least.
Yeah. Well, here's to the Scottish. That though concludes today's Football Weekly. Many, many thanks to producer Camby, Barry, Paul Doyle, Sean for coming in despite his lack of sleep
and his illness, which we're all going to get being in this confined pokey little hole with him.
Right. Best wishes to you there at home, viewers, listeners, and we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. Cheers for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.